Dean Almengestu's work, including his first two novels, have earned him incredible critical acclaim, as well as a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and selection by The New Yorker as one of their 20 under 40 young writers central to their generation. And writing about his new novel, All Our Names, Kirkus Reviews calls Mengestu among the best novelists now at work in America. His previous novels include The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears and How to Read the Air. Again, his latest is All Our Names. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dean Almengestu to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me, Joe. A pleasure to be here.
It is fascinating, having read the two previous novels that I just mentioned, that you consider in many ways this to be a trilogy, and if anything, this novel being a prequel.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. My previous two novels trace the experiences of characters who have been forced to leave their home, and the novels are very much born out of a sense of rupture. What happens when we lose our family, when we lose our homes, and have to reinvent ourselves once more? And this novel has similar themes, definitely, but it also began with a slightly different conceit. Rather than being born out of a sense of rupture, its origin was kind of conceived of as what happens when our narratives converge, what happens when we stop thinking of our political lives and our private lives as being separate and distinct from one another based on geography or ethnicity, and when we take our characters and we begin to rub them up against one another. And so the novel takes place actually before a lot of the political revolutions that forced the characters in my other two novels to leave home. It takes place in that period just after independence, when there's still a lot of hope and optimism in Africa.
Were you writing it at that time, when there was more hope and optimism?
No, I was actually writing it. I began writing this novel in 2007, 2008, just after I'd finished writing my second novel. And I had the sense that, I'd kind of mapped out a sense of loss and trajectory of loss for my characters. And I began very much wanting to create characters who were born out of something other than that. I wanted to begin with characters who were very hopeful and were very optimistic. And at the same time, my other two novels were narrated by men who have left their homes in Ethiopia in particular. In this case, I also wanted to write from the point of view of someone who is uniquely American, somebody who could reflect the other half of my identity as somebody not born in America, but very much raised here and very much a part of this country.
Was that at all a challenge for you, finding that voice?
No. In fact, if anything, the second narrator of the novel is a woman named Helen, and she's a social worker in a small college town in the Midwest, and her voice was actually perhaps the easiest one for me to write out of. After my family left Ethiopia, we came to Peoria, Illinois, and my earliest memories of childhood are very much set around this sort of small Midwestern town, of this sort of community of women who I met through the Southern Baptist Church that my family attended. And so I had a really strong sense of Helen's voice and of her experiences and what defined her, not only emotionally, but also in terms of the landscape that she came from.
I want to go back before we talk about the novel itself, because you mentioned this a few times, and that sense of rupture.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define that, and how do you think, because it is rather universal, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, yeah. And I oftentimes, I have this frustration when we think of the immigrant novel as being somehow distinct or separate from other forms of literature. For me, the immigrant novel is really about rupture. It's about what happens when we lose something vital to us. And migration is a perhaps more dramatic form of that loss, but I tend to think that we're all called upon to recreate ourselves, to reimagine ourselves whenever we lose something important or intimate to ourselves. We lose our family, we lose friends. And every time we experience those large-scale losses in our lives, we're forced to reassess who we are and what we've become. And migration is just one form of that. You lose a country, but even if you've never had that experience, you definitely have lost a house or a childhood or someone you've loved. And that calls you to reconsider yourself, to reimagine not only your past, but also where you might be headed to next.
When you think about the writing of this particular novel, were there strands that had been with you for a very long time and things that went back to your early days as a writer?
Very much so. Part of it was seeing how I could mend these seemingly broken strands of my own private life, not only in terms of drawing on experiences of my family's flight from Ethiopia to America, but also trying to reconcile our experiences here in America and trying to see what happens to our narratives when we're not only writing from the experience of people who have left their homes, but also from the point of view of the people who accepted us when we came to this country. And so for me, it was much a sort of a homage to some of the people that I knew growing up in Peoria, Illinois, trying to write about this type of community, this type of sort of small Midwestern town.
And when it comes to Africa, how much of it was informed by travels to Africa and to, well, actual events as well?
A decent amount. I've had the fortunate of experience since publishing my first novel to work as a journalist, specifically in conflict regions throughout Africa. And every one of those experiences has left me with images, with memories, with impressions that I haven't quite known exactly what to do with. There are always things that never work their way into the stories that you write. And so when writing this novel, I found myself drawing not only on episodes of violence that I had heard about or had partially witnessed, but also in terms of creating characters who were revolutionary figures inside of the novel. And in those cases, I was able to draw on some of the rebel leaders that I'd met in Africa, rebel leaders in Sudan, a colonel in the Congolese army that I'd met recently in 2008. And all of these men allowed me to create portraits of violent but also at the same time very complicated men, men who are responsible for great deals of tragedy and great deals of violence, but are also more than just the totality of those violences. They're also men who act out of a sense of obligation towards their country, and I wanted to try to capture that complexity in the characters in the novel.
How does witnessing that kind of violence change you? Especially when you have a context.
I think for me, oftentimes it made me want to go back to writing fiction more than anything. Experiencing that as a journalist often left me feeling quite frustrated that I didn't quite have the vocabulary or the language or the space or the time to properly complicate those narratives and to try to process them. And so in many ways, I think of fiction as being the space in which those narratives are actually allowed to really fully exist, in which we're allowed to actually step into the lives of the people who are fleeing their homes or who are losing their loved ones as a result of violence. We're allowed to see them in more complicated and more human light. And part of what the frustration of those experiences is the sense that you're never able to allow the reader to step into those experiences fully. And fiction allows you to do that. It allows you to spend years creating a scene or creating a moment so that way the reader comes to it with the sense that this is not that foreign from my own personal life, that I can actually understand what's happening here and that I can also play the role of witness in this narrative.
How much is that creation born from what you know of their experiences and what you know of what led them to that situation and to the complexity of their lives that you just mentioned?
I think I never know as much as I would like to. You know, I think part of the problem is someone may tell you their story, someone may share in great detail the things that they've lost, but it's also contingent upon you being able to imagine them in a greater light. And part of what fiction does, not only I think for the writer, but also for the reader, is it allows us to engage that part of our imagination, and that part of our imagination is also what allows us to really move beyond the borders of our lives, to really step into the souls and hearts of other people and to experience their loss as intimately as we experience the loss in our own private lives. So as a journalist, I'm able to only capture a part of that. And then what I'm obliged to do as a novelist is to go back home and sit with those experiences and create characters out of them and to try to imagine my way into them so that way hopefully my readers are able to imagine their way into those lives as well.
Dinah Mengesu is our guest. The title of the new novel is All Our Names. It is published by Knopf. When it comes to this story, it is very much rooted in a love story and in trying to find that connection.
Yes, very much so. You know, the novel has a lot of large-scale events that happen around it, but at its heart, at its core for me, it's very much a portrait of love, of three different types of love. There's love between Isaac, the narrator, and Helen, the other narrator in the novel. There's the love of two friends, two young men growing up together in Kampala who aspire to be more than what their lives have allowed them to be. And then there's a love between one of the characters and an older man named Joseph, who serves as a mentor for him. And all three portraits of love come under attack in various ways. All three portraits of love are called to bear an unnecessary amount of burden. And all three portraits, I think, also serve as the source of redemption for the characters at the same time.
I thought it was fascinating to discover and to explore that capacity of love, of what we are capable of and what we're not capable of.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I think the characters are oftentimes unaware of how great of a capacity they have to love one another, and they come up against strong prejudices. So Isaac and Helen are trying to figure out how much can their love bear, given the sort of racial prejudices of a small town in America in the early 1970s. And so they have this very intimate love that exists behind doors in a very private world. And for them, the challenge becomes, well, how do you actually move that love outside? How do you allow it to become something more than just a private experience, with something that you can actually share with the people around you? And there's a lot of skepticism and doubt, I think, between them, whether or not they're capable of doing so. And if there's a trajectory in their relationship over the course of the novel, it's one of their deepening understanding of just how profound and how vital that love is for them, and how much that love might actually be the thing that allows them to move on with their lives, to really become more complete, more full human beings.
You were speaking of this earlier about the converging of the narratives. And so for the actual writing of that, is it mapped out for you, or does it come, okay, I want to look at this and then discover how they can come together?
Oh, I've always wished that I had a map. You know, I tend to begin my books with a very small idea or a very small sentence. In this case, the novel began with a group of young men on a college campus who were very optimistic and who were trying to create new names for themselves. They wanted to be revolutionary figures, and they were branding themselves and naming themselves after the heroes in their lives. And I thought perhaps the novel would remain there, but then really quickly I realized that there was a second half to this narrative, and that second half was going to take place definitely inside of the United States. And that second half needed to be told from an entirely different perspective, that there was a voice that had been missing from my other two novels. And this woman, Helen, became that filler. She became the one who stepped in and filled that empty space in the story. And from there, the novel became, at least in my imagination, a kind of dialogue between these two narrative voices, between Helen and Isaac. And while their stories may take place in very different contexts, each one is somehow responding to the other, as far as I could think of them. You know, so one thing would happen to Isaac in Kampala, and Helen would tell her story from the Midwest, but she was very much in conversation with Isaac's story the entire time.
Talk a little bit about Helen and Isaac and that relocation that they must deal with.
Yeah, Helen is a very kind and also at the same time slightly frustrated soul. She's a social worker in a small town in the Midwest, and she has kind of ordered her life around a very small canvas, and she's grown rather frustrated and dismayed by the limitations of her world and of her life. And into that steps this mysterious man named Isaac, who Helen is supposed to be responsible for. And Isaac comes off this plane, and Helen is really the first person to witness and see him. And their relationship becomes, I think, this sort of process of her drawing closer to him, not only emotionally, but also trying to unravel the various strands of his identity. He is the sort of stranger who comes to town, and from parts of the novel, he very much remains that stranger. It's his mystery, which is part of what really attaches Helen to him. And at the same time, that mystery also needs to be unveiled and needs to be released. And Helen's love for Isaac becomes the way and the means through which that mystery is resolved.
And when you talk about the mystery, ultimately where the title comes from, this is Isaac has many names at birth, and sort of to discover what they are, what they were, and shedding them along the way.
Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, there's a very, you know, literal way in which understanding Isaac's identity and who he is and what has made him the man that he is very much the only, that happens through this process of understanding what his name is and where that name comes from. And at the, in the same time, you know, I was conscious of the fact that one of the privileges or one of the things that we often associate with migrant experience in America since the birth of this country is that people come to this country with the ability to reinvent themselves. They come here with the desire to perhaps unshackle themselves from the past and create a new home and a new life for themselves. And Isaac is was a part of that tradition. He is, he has a new name and he has multiple histories and names behind him. And when he comes here, the question is how much of that past is still tethered to him? How much is he allowed to reinvent himself? And so there is this sort of ongoing process of negotiating both past and present through the names.
In writing about it, and you talked about this process a moment ago of the creation of the narratives and then their convergence, but for you, do you have to have a full grasp of migration and your feeling as an immigrant of what that is like to fully express it in an artistic way?
Yeah. You know, even my experiences of an immigrant are fairly imaginary. You know, I came to this country when I was 2 years old. I have no memories really of Ethiopia as a child. I grew up, you know, in a small southern town. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago later on, eating hot dogs and playing baseball. So to some degree, I never actually really had that traditional sense of an immigrant experience of actually having given up something or lost something. What I did grow up with, though, is a very strong sense of loss, of knowing that my parents had lost something important to them. And that loss was fairly abstract. I didn't know what Ethiopia looked like or what the language looked like, but I did know what it meant to know that my grandfather passed away while we were in a house in Peoria, Illinois, and that there was no way to mourn him in person. So I grew up knowing that we all bear a certain amount of loss and that migration is one form of that loss, and that loss takes multiple shapes, takes multiple forms, and really the best and only way to understand it is to reduce it to the level of the individual, to reduce it to the level of very personal things. So the loss of a country is quite kind of abstract, but the loss of a friend isn't. And so my stories of migration are very much born out of very small personal losses. You know, the character in my first novel, his migration experience really is about the death of his father. When his father passes away, that's the rupture that happens not only with that lineage, but also very much with that home and with that country. And the same is true in this novel as well. You know, Isaac's loss is less about, to some degree, less about the loss of a country, more about the loss of friends and this time and this period of his life that he thought would be better than it actually was.
Is there a balance for you? My apologies if this is an overly psychological question. But in the is there a balance for you of filling in those gaps of what is imaginary and what is true?
For me, there's a wonderful line from a novel by Marilynne Robinson in Housekeeping, where one of her characters says, "Facts tell us nothing. If anything, it's facts that need explaining." Mm. And for me, fiction is the place in which we get to move beyond facts. You know, there's a limited amount of information that the facts of our lives might actually tell us. And for me, what I'm much more interested in is trying to understand how those historical details or those factual points in our lives actually continue to resonate in more complex ways that we don't get to understand so easily that we actually have to kind of sit down and process over the course of a novel.
You have a line in the novel, "No one needs to learn how to kill, but it took the foreigners who came to Africa to show us that it meant nothing to do so." Talk a little bit about how that plays itself out.
Yeah, there's these sort of growing episodes of violence that happen throughout the scenes that take place in Africa. There's you know, that violence is born initially out of a sense of optimism and out of a profound sense of frustration that the revolution that brought independence to Uganda in this case hasn't actually been really properly fulfilled because the leaders have now become dictators and tyrants. And so the characters in this novel begin to assume that the only way out of that is to take arms. You know, there's no other form of recourse other than violence. And the character who says those lines is also, I think, trying to argue that one of the effects of the colonial legacy, one of the effects of occupation, was to sort of devalue the meaning of a human life. It was to sort of actually say that it is actually nothing to kill in order to achieve a political intent, or the political aim is always greater than the life of any one person. And so colonialism certainly proved that, and the characters tragically continue to prove that themselves by going through the same process of political violence as a way of trying to change what they feel is a very flawed and corrupt system.
This idea that the violence is so often described in religious terms and in ethnic terms, but there's a step beyond.
Well, because also the use of religion and ethnicity in violence, whether it takes place, you know, in Africa or here in this country, those are always just political weapons. Those are weapons that are used by political leaders in order to cast divisions across the society, because that's the easiest way to maintain and assert your authority. The more divided a country is, the more divided a population is, the easier it is for one person or one group of people to maintain their control over it. And so you do that by using whatever tools and means you have. If it needs to be religion, then you can use religion. You turn it into a discourse of us versus them, of these are the foreigners, these are the others. If it's a question of ethnicity, you do the same thing. It's very easy to frighten people and to turn them against one another when you use that type of discourse, when you use that type of language. But it's also very easy, I think, to also retreat from that, to come back from that as well and say, you know, these divisions are actually fairly arbitrary, that you sort of strip away the color of his skin, you strip away someone's religious identity and belief, and what you're left with at the end is a human being who wants the same thing as I do, a better life for myself, for my children, for my family, a place where I feel like I can actually assert some control over my identity, over my future. We're all fairly basic on that scale.
Of wanting control.
Yeah. Of wanting peace, of wanting to be able to
or a feeling of control.
Yeah. Over just our very small domain, not in a way that's that's control over the world in a totalitarian way, but just in a way that says, like, I want to be able to do this with my life someday. You know, I want to be able to believe that I can go to school and become a doctor, or that I want to be a lawyer, or that my children will have greater opportunities than I do. Those are the greatest forms of control, I think, that we really seek.
We spoke a moment ago about the idea of fact and fiction, but you play with the notion very much in this novel of secrets.
Yeah.
Which is a fascinating thing to add to that equation.
Yeah. I'm withholding as much as I can throughout the course of the novel as of course as a device, as a tool to captivate the reader, of course. You want the reader to be to allow themselves to engage with these characters and to try to figure out what's the mystery that lies at the core of them. And at the same time, you know, the novel deliberately evades certain forms of historical definitions, because for me, this story isn't about what happened in one country at one particular time period, so much as the story of a group of people, of men and women who are forced to confront very difficult choices in their lives, who are forced and try to make something better out of themselves and out of their environments around them. And using Kampala and using the Midwest in the 1970s was one way of showing how these political histories are oftentimes thought of as very distinct and disparate, but yet at the same time are actually quite similar, when you can kind of see them stripped bare of some of the technical details that surround them.
As we mentioned at the beginning, that this is a bit of a prequel. Do you see yourself going in a completely different direction in the future?
I think so, actually. It's hard to know, but you know, these three novels have been so closely intertwined in my imagination for so long, and one novel began always before the other one was even finished, that I felt myself sort of following this idea to its fullest and most logical extreme to some degree. You know, like it's like you were having a conversation at a dinner party that just happened to take 7 years or 8 years in this case to end. And it's possible that conversation now is finally over, not that it's resolved, but that I have done the most that I can with it, and that now it's time to cast my eyes elsewhere and see what comes next. So I'm personally really curious. You know, you do feel slightly liberated, and at the same time, slightly baffled about what to do next. You know, you think, I can write a story now about vampires and werewolves, and maybe that will be what happens next. It'd be great.
Dina Mengistu's latest is All Our Names. It is published by Knopf. Dina, thank you very much for being with us. It was a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.